Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the Friday News Roundup, where we check in with area journalists for more on the regional stories making headlines this week. The first set of property takings for the replacement of the Sagamore Bridge goes into effect in a matter of weeks. And in New Bedford, the sheriff of Bristol County is making a renewed push to close the Ash Street Jail. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with those stories. Good morning, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
So let's talk about the bridge project. You reported this week that four property owners in Bourne will have their deeds transferred to the state by eminent domain in January. This is quite a difficult thing for those residents. Tell us more what's going to happen.
Yes, this is a big step. So the state will be formally taking the first four properties for the bridge project. In total, with these eminent domain takings, there are 14 homes and one business, plus several parcels of land that are listed as vacant in the documents. And the state is taking those. I know at least one of the first four is a residential homeowner because she identified herself at a public meeting this week. The other three, I'm not sure what type of properties they are. But the homeowner who spoke out this week, her name is Mary Gallerani from the Round Hill neighborhood, which is at the Sagamore Bridge on the Cape side. And I actually met her 2 years ago when we first learned about this eminent domain situation. I walked through the neighborhood. She talked then and she talked again in the meeting this week at Mass Maritime about the heartbreak of leaving her home at her age after raising her children there. She says she's going to be turning 90 in March. She's lived there since 1958. And she says that she got notice of this date less than a month ago. She says the closing is going to be January 9th. So on top of everything else for her, she says it's heartbreaking to have this knowledge of this date heading into Christmas. But she does have a lawyer representing her on this issue. Her home has a bridge view. It has a water view at least part of the year, which would be hard to replicate if she did move. So she did not want to say too much about her next steps because she does have legal representation.
Officials from the Healey administration were leading the meeting this week. How did they respond to those comments?
The leader of the bridge project was there, Louisa Piwanski. She did express some sympathy. She said they intentionally made the closing dates for these deed transfers, for these transactions, to be after the holidays in January, although clearly not very far after the holidays. And the homeowner here felt that the notice was too close to be the notice came too close to Christmas. But to be clear, this is not the first time, of course, that the property owners were notified their properties were going to be taken. The state has been talking about it for a couple of years. And then back in March for this particular neighborhood, Round Hill, they did receive official notice that the eminent domain would happen at some point. Yeah. Piwanski, the leader of this project for the state, she said they do sometimes offer owners the chance to rent back their own homes for a period to stay. She wouldn't really specify how long that would be. She said it could be a period of months. And construction isn't scheduled to start until late 2027. So they do have a little bit of time there.
Now, the purpose of this meeting from the state's point of view was to share the details of a recent federal document that they had to file. It gives a lot of details about the bridge project. What are some of the things that they highlighted in that presentation?
They went through a series of slides showing what they call the impacts of the project, because that's what this document is supposed to be about. It's called the Environmental Impact Statement. But environment here is that term is used very broadly. So it's not just about things like water quality and wildlife, but it's also about how the bridge project will affect the living environment for people around it. So they went through some slides about what the effect would be on historic properties that overlook the bridge, on floodplains, because there's going to be more pavement and things like that. Most of these so-called impacts listed by the state and their slides were actually positive things that they say that the project will provide, like better safety for pedestrians. But they did reveal that there will be 51 acres of new pavement.
Wow.
Now, in a way, that's a little deceiving because much of that pavement is on the bridges themselves. They are wider, much wider, mm-hmm. and they are longer because they're no longer going to have their like main abutments in the water. They're going to be farther out, which means also more pavement. So that does create more runoff and things like that. But they said there will be prevention measures to avoid pollution from that.
Mm. Now, people in the audience were invited to speak. What kind of comments did they have?
Yeah, there were a few different concerns. One theme that came up a couple of times was the experience that cyclists and pedestrians will be having with these new bridges. The state, of course, wants to do the best they can to encourage pedestrian and cycling use, but some folks in the audience were not pleased with how that's going to happen. John York from Bourne said the path over the Sagamore Bridge will make the walk significantly longer based on the layout of that path. He said some people from an apartment complex to walk, say, over the bridge to the park and ride would now be walking more like 2 miles compared to less than one in the original layout. But the state has not provided an official count of what those walking distances would be. Another critic related to the biking said there's an at-grade crossing where the bike path crosses a canal service road that should be separated. And then another person talked about the traffic issue, the idea that more traffic could be coming onto the Cape, mm-hmm. Because, of course, if travel is easier, right, if word gets out that it's not difficult to get over the bridge, will a lot more people come? And the state says, well, that's not our intent. That's not what this is designed to do, to bring more cars. But Stephen Buckley, who's a Chatham resident, said whether that's your intention or not, he believes it will happen.
Yeah. You also reported that the threat of lost federal funding for the Sagamore Bridge seems to be over. So what happened there?
Yeah, so that possible loss of funding we had reported before came from a tweet by the Trump administration's Office of Management and Budget. They said this was during the shutdown, and they said that there was going to be a pause in money for various projects from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It actually did not name the Cape specifically, but officials had heard that the Cape was included in that. And what was at stake there was $350 million. So it's not by any means the majority of the funding, but it was a meaningful amount. But this week, Louisa Piwanski from the state said that really turned out to just be a tweet because the money was never actually rescinded. And now that the shutdown is over, it seems like that issue has passed.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to another story about the very antique Ash Street Jail in New Bedford. Public conversations about closing the jail have been going on for years, but now the Bristol County Sheriff is making a renewed effort to get it closed. Tell us about that.
Yes, it is very antique. It opened in 1888, and I believe actually part of the complex is even older than that. And especially under the previous sheriff, activists had been pressing for quite a while to have that jail closed. They claimed the conditions there were poor. Now, under Sheriff Paul Heroux, he says that he does support closing Ash Street, but he defends the conditions there. He says it's old, but it's not unsafe or inhumane. But now he does believe in closing it, and he's making a fresh effort to do that. For one thing, he says construction costs are going up, which they kind of always do. But he now has an estimate to do the work they would have to do at the main Bristol County Jail in Dartmouth that would be necessary to house the inmates from Ash Street there. It's about 100 inmates. He says that would cost $10 million up front. And the main thing there is that the Dartmouth Jail needs locks on the cell doors where those folks would be going because, believe it or not, half of the 22 units in Dartmouth only have a lock on the outside of the unit and not on the cells themselves.
Huh, interesting.
In those units, they're sharing a restroom. And if you put locks on the doors, then you also need to pay to install a toilet in each cell. So that's where the $10 million comes in. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's the case he's trying to make about why Ash Street should be closed?
Well, efficiency and saving money are probably the biggest ones. Sheriff Heroux says the move, in spite of that $10 million upfront cost, would pay for itself in less than 3 years. And that is because over at Ash Street, they are spending $800,000 a year on utilities and maintenance. Plus, if you brought the Ash Street employees over to Dartmouth, then they would have fewer overtime costs over in Dartmouth. And they wouldn't be this is probably not a big cost thing, but they would be able to stop moving meals over. There is a kitchen in Ash Street, but they're not actively using it. They're bringing meals over from Dartmouth. So it would just consolidate things over in Dartmouth. And he says the main jail also offers more programming that folks cannot access from Ash Street.
Is there any opposition?
I didn't really find any direct opposition, but I did find some concerns about the future of the Ash Street complex in New Bedford if it were to no longer serve as a jail. And there's a little bit of push and pull over how the planning process for the future of that property would unfold. Sheriff Hureau says he shouldn't be the one to plan it because it is a state property. It's located in the city of New Bedford. And once it's no longer a jail, then it really has nothing to do with him. But in New Bedford, Mayor John Mitchell says that if this jail move isn't funded and there is no timeline for the funding, then he is not going to spend time on a planning process for something that could be a decade away. So that's kind of the dynamic there. This complex takes up the better part of a city block in New Bedford. So it is a significant property in the city. But the timeline for closing the jail is directly related to getting state money to actually accomplish the move.
And about the funding, you reported that the sheriff's trying two different funding sources but hopes to get direct support from the legislature.
Yes. So Hureau says he's been advised to apply for a state grant to do it. He's not really satisfied with that option. And that's one of the reasons he's going public now. He says he feels like grants are pretty uncertain. Not every sheriff is going to get what they ask for. And he feels the locks on the cells are a critical function. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he said he does plan to apply for the grant and kind of do his due diligence there. But what he's really hoping for is that some local legislators will put a line item in the state budget and rally support to just pay for it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about one more story briefly. Last week, you reported on the court order that vacated President Trump's decision to block offshore wind permits. This week, you're learning more about what happens next. So tell us about that.
Sure. Yep. The final court order was actually posted online just last night. But right now, it just formalizes the ruling we reported earlier this week, where the judge said the Trump administration should not be blocking the forward movement of offshore wind permits. I talked with one of the plaintiffs in this case from a pro-wind group called the Alliance for Clean Energy New York. And the director there says that the judge is going to take some time to see if the Trump administration complies with this. If they move permits along, then we're all set. But if they don't, then at some point later, they could go back to court to seek some kind of enforcement action, which could be something like the judge just saying the administration has a timeline where it has to act on the permits.
All right. CAA's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette.
Thanks.
The Steamship Authority wasted millions of public dollars on its long-delayed website project. That's according to a scathing report out yesterday from the State Office of the Inspector General. Inspector General Jeffrey Shapiro says one of the major points of failure for the Steamship Authority was choosing to redo its website before getting a new reservation system.
If the music stopped today, $2.3 million was either wasted or mismanaged from this project. It's debatable if the project that has been shelved can ever come back to life. If it isn't, that $2.3 million will go to $4.1 million, and it may go on beyond that.
That's Inspector General Shapiro talking to CAI yesterday. CAI, not the only ones reporting on this story. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette joins us. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Mindy.
So the Inspector General had some pretty harsh words saying this project was ill-conceived, poorly executed, a waste of public funds, as he said, a cascade of failures.
Yeah, you don't hear cascade of failures very often. That was a new one for me. But yeah, I think, like you said, scathing is kind of the word here. Really pulled no punches in criticizing the Steamship Authority General Manager, Bob Davis, as well as the board for a lack of oversight in how this all rolled out.
Yeah. And basically, he also criticized them for putting the communications person in charge of this. And he said, you know, nothing personal, but they didn't choose a person with the right expertise.
Yeah. I mean, this project, this has been going back a few years. They first started looking at putting up a new website in 2020. They kind of got the ball rolling in 2022. But what you know, the real issue here is people remember that the website has failed. The reservation system has failed on opening day several times, just been overloaded. It's owned by a guy who lives in Wisconsin who's in his 70s. And that's been a kind of a major concern is what happens if this man doesn't want to do this anymore. And then kind of the reservation system is kind of floundering. But so the Inspector General's main issue, like you said, was if we go forward with a website, it's kind of that's the window dressing on top of the reservation system. And so we're spending a lot of money on something that is kind of the lipstick on the pig in this situation.
He did say he was cautiously optimistic with a new general manager coming in.
A lot of this was aimed at how the general manager, Bob Davis, had handled this situation. Alex Kryczka was hired earlier this year and is coming in January to be the new GM. Jeffrey Shapiro, the inspector general, said, you know, this is an opportune time to kind of make some changes. But there were still some lingering concerns because the general manager is stepping into a senior advisor position, still at the Steamship Authority for another year or so. So it's, you know, if we, he kind of said, you're hiring someone for a senior advisor position who has made several critical missteps in this situation.
And so the recommendation also here is that the legislature set up a special commission.
Yeah, he had several different recommendations, but that's kind of the big whopping one is looking at advising, he wants to create a commission from people on the Cape, the islands, and New Bedford to look at do we change how the Steamship Authority government structure is run? Is there changes in the legislation from, I think, 65 years ago that created the Steamship Authority? Do we need to change something kind of structurally at the Steamship Authority to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
Yeah. And so far, no comment from the Steamship Authority, right?
The Steamship Authority, the management sent us a statement yesterday saying we're still reading it. We just got this large report. We're working our way through it. The two members of the board put out a statement saying they are open to embracing the suggestions in here and looking at how to make this better for the customer and for people, residents of the islands.
Another story you have this week is on school expenses, and it costs more than $34,000 per student last year. That seems like a lot. So how does that compare with other regionalized school systems?
Regionalization has been somewhat of a dirty word on the vineyard for a long time. You know, we have six towns here, and school officials had done a study to look at, you know, how does this all work? What could be done? How do we compare to elsewhere? We have higher per student costs than Nantucket, Nauset over on the Cape. So it's a concern for people out here is, you know, why do we cost so much more than other places? There are points to just the way that we structure our different school. We, I think, technically have five different school districts on the island, even though they kind of all fall under one single umbrella. So, yeah, a lot of these numbers were kind of eye-opening to folks here.
Yeah. So what's next?
You know, there's a subcommittee in the school district that's looking at how to move forward here. This would be a big change, so I'm imagining this is going to probably be slow rolling if this ever does happen. But you know, this is all kind of coming as the island is looking at building a new regional high school, the one place we have regionalized, and so there's going to be a lot of talk about ways to deal with money. The high school project is pegged at $333 million, the biggest capital project in island history, I think. So it's definitely going to be a conversation on money saving as we go forward here.
Ethan Gender from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up, a bid to nullify Nantucket's vote legalizing short-term rentals submitted to the Attorney General and the latest on North Atlantic right whale calving season. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Massachusetts Attorney General is being asked to nullify Nantucket's vote legalizing short-term rentals. Jason Graziadei is here with more. Hi.
Good morning.
So just when you thought this debate was over, right?
Yeah, it's a debate that we've been having on Nantucket for 5 years now. At the special town meeting in November, there was what everyone's kind of thought was a decisive vote to legalize and codify short-term rentals into the island's zoning code, which you know, people thought had settled the debate and would end the litigation that's been happening, neighbors suing neighbors over running short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods. But we learned this week that a challenge to the vote, that the special town meeting vote, has been submitted to the state attorney general. And this was done by an attorney who's been involved with this debate for almost the entire time. Her name is Nina Pickering Cook. She's working on behalf of an unidentified resident and voter of Nantucket, and they are challenging the validity of the vote and asking the attorney general to step in on the basis of a state law which basically precludes any zoning ordinance or bylaw which had been voted down in the previous two, you know, it had been voted down. It precludes it from coming back to town meeting for 2 years. So if it gets, if something gets voted down, if a zoning ordinance is defeated, it under the state law, a similar or exactly identical bylaw is not allowed to come back for 2 years. Now, she lays out in a six-page letter, which we posted on our website and people can read, the reasons why she believes this bylaw is similar to ones that were defeated in previous years at town meeting that attempted to do similar things, codify short-term rentals into our zoning code. This question was actually did, of course, come up in the lead up to special town meeting. There's an opinion from Nantucket's town council, John Giorgio, in which he very clearly says this is does not meet the 2 year bar. It does not fall under this state law. And there was a determination working with him and the town meeting moderator to review this. And the bylaw did go forward to voters under the premise that it was not entirely or exactly similar to what had been voted down before. So, yeah, go ahead.
It passed with 2/3 majority. So what's the likelihood that this bid will exceed? I mean, will succeed because, you know, that's 2/3 majority.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even about, you know, how strongly it did pass with the 2/3 majority, as you said, 71% of the vote. The question is whether it's violated this state law, which regards zoning ordinances. So the attorney general is going to weigh in here and make a determination on this. And we'll have to see. We're going to be tracking it. But again, I think people are. The opponents, you know, have been fighting against this type of zoning bylaw amendment and codification, obviously feel that this is a valid argument.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people who came out, you know, we had a record turnout at that special town meeting. The line, you know, stretched out of the door of the middle school.
Right.
I think we're hoping that this was the end and that the issue had been settled. But, of course, it is not.
No, it is not. And it's a lot of speculation who's behind this, right?
Yeah, there is. So the woman who the attorney who filed this petition on behalf of an client has previously worked for a political action group on the island called Act Now, and this is the group that has been fighting to put restrictions and regulate short-term rentals for the past 5 years. She says she is not working on behalf of Act Now, and that they are not paying her legal. You know, there's nothing that they have nothing to do with this effort. However, the sponsor of Article 1, which was the zoning bylaw that passed at the special town meeting, believes that Act Now is behind this effort. He is quoted in our story and talking about how he believes, given the affiliation that attorney Nina Pickering Cook has had with Act Now in the past, that's his conclusion of, sort of what's at play and who's behind this effort.
All right. Another story you have this week involves the debate over how to replace the high school's athletic complexes, natural grass and asphalt track or turf field and synthetic track.
Yeah. And this is another debate we've been having for years on the island, and a previous proposal to redo the Nantucket High School athletic complex with turf fields was basically withdrawn under opposition from people who were very concerned about PFAS chemicals that they believe are, part of the turf fields and potentially dangerous to Nantucket's aquifer, that they could leach out, and that the turf fields are problematic with respect to those forever chemicals that we all know about now, PFAS. You've seen this issue play out in other areas. The Vineyard, I think, believed took a vote to banned turf fields. It came back, and there was a strong push from parents, from student athletes here in Nantucket, for the school to move forward with a turf field rather than a grass field. That proposal was approved and moved forward by the school committee earlier this week. And then we moved to the Board of Health yesterday, and you have a potential movement and questions and suggestions that the Board of Health might actually move to ban turf fields over those same concerns about PFAS. So this is going to continue to play out. The Board of Health has scheduled a special meeting, or is going to schedule a special meeting to discuss this further. But again, very sort of divisive and a lot of questions about PFAS and the safety of these turf fields versus a natural grass alternative.
Yeah, and like you said, more debate to come for sure. Jason Grazia today with the Nantucket Current. Thank you, Jason.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
We have talked in recent weeks about the future of the Playhouse on the old Monomoy Theater property. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with the latest. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So denial to demolish is upheld.
Exactly. The select board in Chatham on Tuesday, after a long hearing, didn't buy the argument of the owners of the Monomoy Theater, former Monomoy Theater property, that the old Playhouse is in poor condition and is not historic. And they upheld the Historic Business Commission's decision not to allow it to be demolished. They were pretty clear that they don't plan to return a theater to the property. And whatever happens with this particular building, whether they have to tear it down or whether they're allowed to tear it down or whether the building has to be restored and renovated, it's not going to be a theater. Mm-hmm. You know, that's been a concern of a lot of people in town, but they're saying that they're not going to do that. They're going to convert it to a commercial and retail type space.
Mm. And so moving on to another story, what's the latest on plans for development on the Sunday School ice cream property?
Yeah, the proposal for condos at the former Sunday School property on Route 28 in Harwichport has been downsized by the owners of the property. And instead of having 28-unit condominiums, it will be a 28-unit rental facility. And the units will be a lot smaller than they were in the previous proposal. They've basically reduced the size of the building by almost 42%, and they've downscaled a number of other aspects of the property, like parking and the amount of the property that will be hardscaped. And this met with a lot of approval from both planning board and residents, who had basically said that the initial proposal was too big for the neighborhood and was going to cause disruption, but they feel that they'll be okay with this newest proposal.
Mm. And you've also been following the story of a suit brought against the Community of Jesus, and now we have a new nonprofit offering support to former members. Tell us about that.
Sure. This is a group called Rock Harbor Truth, and they're working on establishing themselves as a nonprofit. They've started a website, and their basic goal is to provide support for people who are either former Community of Jesus members or current members who want to leave the community. As we've talked about, Mindy, the Community of Jesus is a religious organization based at Rock Harbor in Orleans. And this past summer, there was a lawsuit filed against the organization claiming that they illegally used child labor to construct a arts facility that they built in Brewster a few years back. But this particular initiative it was started by two former members of the Community of Jesus, Sean DeLude and Bonnie Sampino, who feel that when they left the community when they were teenagers, they had nowhere to turn for support. Mm-hmm. And, they experienced things like homelessness and, inability to connect with people after their experiences. So they've started this organization to try to help folks through connecting them to various support services in town or elsewhere. They've started a podcast where they interview former community members to talk about their experiences. And it's really kind of an effort to provide that support.
Yeah.
To folks who may feel that they're alone after you know, leaving what many describe as an abusive situation with the community.
Yeah. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
It's calving season for the critically endangered North Atlantic right whales, and CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes has been following news out of the calving grounds off the coast of the southeast U.S. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
So you reported on some good news and some bad news this week. Let's start with the good news.
The good news is there are some new North Atlantic right whales in the world. Because there are only 72 reproductive females in the entire population, every birth is a big deal. And we're up to 5 so far this season.
And how long does the season last?
It starts usually the latter part of November. It started a little early this year, actually, but it runs through April. So hopefully this is just the beginning of the birth announcement. Mm.
What can you tell us about the newest whales and their moms?
Well, there's a mother named Botchi, and her calf, she and her calf were spotted by an aerial survey team from Clearwater Marine Aquarium Research Institute on Wednesday, December 10th. They were seen swimming off Doughboy Sound in Georgia. Botchi is 18 years old, and this is likely her third calf. She was part of a three-way calf swap back in 2016, where she ended up raising a calf born to another mother. Scientists think Botchi lost her own calf, and that was why she was able to nurse another one. And her sister, Millipede, has also had a calf this season. And then the most recent calf sighting happened last Thursday, December 11th. That was a whale called Squilla and her calf, who were sighted off Sullivan's Island Lighthouse in South Carolina. Squilla is a year older than Botchi, and this is her second known calf. Her first calf died from a chronic entanglement at the age of 3. Mm,
so sad. And you also reported on a whale in distress. Tell us about that.
That's right. It's a 3-year-old male that scientists call Division, and he's also entangled in fishing gear. He was spotted by an aerial survey team near St. Simon's Island in Georgia, and trained responders actually stripped away some of the gear but weren't able to get it all. NOAA fisheries biologists categorized the injury as serious. He has fishing line wrapped around his head and mouth, cutting into his blowhole and embedded in his upper jaw. Heather Pettis, she's a North Atlantic right whale expert at the New England Aquarium. She called the entanglement significant and life-threatening.
NOAA says it's
terrible. Yeah. NOAA says any additional response efforts will depend on Division's condition and as well as the weather and whether and where they spot him again. The last time he was seen before this month was in July up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence off the coast of Canada, and they say he was cure-free at that time.
We'll keep our fingers crossed. All right. CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Mindy.
Coming up, turtles are not the only creatures washing up on Cape beaches in the winter. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. The Crown and Anchor is a cornerstone of Provincetown's gay nightlife and entertainment scene, and next month it's changing hands. CAI's Gilda Geist talks to Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent to learn more.
What is the Crown and Anchor, and what is its significance in Provincetown?
The Crown and Anchor is a nightclub and entertainment complex right in the heart of Commercial Street. It has 6 bars, 3 performance spaces, a restaurant, 17 hotel rooms, a swimming pool on the beach. And it has been really at the center of a lot of gay entertainment in particular. The theme weeks that come to Provincetown in the summer, Gay Pride, Bear Week, Women's Week, Carnival, a lot of those events rely on big dance parties that they'll hold in the Paramount Room, drag queen performances that happen in a lot of these different stages. It's just a really like central place for the community.
Who were the previous owners of the Crown and Anchor, and do we know why they were selling?
We do. Paolo Martini and Jonathan Hawkins bought the property in the fall of 21. From the owners before, Rick Murray and Bill Dougal, that Jonathan had been working for a while as an entertainment manager, sort of a recruiter of talent and a performer himself. 4 years is not all that long of a tenure, but Jonathan and Paolo did wind up divorcing. They originally filed last year, and they told us in the story that they were actually looking for buyers even before that to pass on the property to another gay owner who would hold the values of the community in terms of a performance space, a space for artists, and a space where people could come from all over the country and feel very comfortable.
Tell us about the new owner.
So Tristan Shoecraft owns 100 companies, he told us, more than 100, the most famous of which is Mister, which is responsible for about 20% of all of the PrEP, HIV prevention medication, that goes out through the mail in the country from AIDS services organizations and healthcare clinics around the country. In addition to that online platform, he's started buying hotel and bar properties in the last 4 years or so, including the Abbey in West Hollywood, a very famous venue. It's actually in the Pink Pony Club song, supposed to be about the Abbey, as well as gay hotels in San Juan, Puerto Rico, Puerto Vallarta. He's got a property in Rio de Janeiro and several in Fire Island, all before closing on the Crown and Anchor, which is set to happen in January.
What has the new owner said about any changes he plans to bring to the Crown and Anchor?
Trist Puerto Vallarta is the first hotel property that has opened since Tristan Shoecraft took it over. I haven't been. It's supposed to be very sleek. Still a lot of drag performances, people from all over the country flying in the winter, mostly to perform in Mexico. So he said that obviously performances are going to continue to be part of the Crown and Anchor. It's going to be a renovation, not a full rebuild. It's in the FEMA velocity zone. You really can't do full rebuilds at this point in that kind of condition. But that renovation is going to include improvements to the hotel, improvements to the pool area, maintaining a lot of performances, and maintaining the theme weeks that have been really important to Provincetown for the last many years.
I thought it was interesting what he had said in the interview about employee housing. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Absolutely. So in addition to being a really important venue, the Crown and Anchor owns 27 bedrooms of employee housing, which makes it one of the largest landlords in town. So we did some reporting around those tenants who are going to be moving out in January. The prior owners are going to put them up in hotel rooms through April. There's not a lot of housing available in Provincetown, even in winter. So that was an important consideration. And then Tristan said that he already owns employee housing in Fire Island. He talked about the shabby condition it was in when he got it and that that bothered him and that he spent money renovating it up to standards that he thought were appropriate for people who work 6 days a week. Standards that he said needed to be high. They needed to include good bedding, good lighting, televisions, and the kind of amenities that people who work hard, he said, ought to be provided. So there is going to be renovation of the staff housing units in Provincetown. It'll take place over this winter and then presumably be open for employees to move into when the Crown and Anchor reopens, probably in the month of May.
That's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gilda.
And WCAI's Gilda Geis now checks in with our State House reporter Katie Lannon for the latest from Beacon Hill.
Last month, the state's Anti-Semitism Commission came out with a report about anti-Semitism in Massachusetts. Remind us, what were the main findings?
So this report really looks at an increase in anti-Semitic incidents and hate crimes, describing anti-Semitism in schools as pervasive and escalating, and a serious concern in higher education institutions as well, not just K-12 schools. The commission also found that anti-Semitic incidents are likely underreported in Massachusetts and that it's not always clear what qualifies as a hate crime under state law, which can affect the response by law enforcement.
So now the governor's office has announced that it'll be working on implementing the recommendations in the report. What do those recommendations look like?
There's a lot of them, and it's a pretty broad report. It looks at schools, the workplace, law enforcement. So among the themes here are really promoting education and awareness of Jewish heritage and of anti-Semitism. So there's recommendations for anti-bias training, for making sure there are plans in schools for safe and supportive environments, and making sure that there's clear ways to report hate crimes and bias-related incidents. There's a recommendation that law enforcement take clear steps to work with religious institutions ahead of holy days, and that schools create clear policies around religious holidays.
This week, new regulations about social cannabis use are being filed with the Secretary of State. So what did the regulations say about on-site consumption of marijuana?
The regulations will set up three different types of licenses for businesses that want to offer their customers a way to consume cannabis on site. So one is for dispensaries that want to open maybe a lounge or a tasting room. One is for businesses that aren't already in the cannabis space. So think a yoga studio or a movie theater that wants to find a way to incorporate cannabis into its regular business. And then there's a temporary license for events and festivals. The regulations also lay out a lot of health and safety rules. So there'll be staff trainings. There'll be steps that are required to try and make sure that people aren't driving while impaired or over-consuming. And there's a lot to be said about how municipalities are going to be able to opt into this process if they want to host a social use business. Provincetown is one of the areas that's indicated they might be interested in taking this leap. We still probably won't see social consumption sites open up for maybe another year or longer.
Economic experts are already making predictions about next year's state budget. What are they saying?
Yeah, this is about a month out from when Governor Healey is due to file her proposal for the next state budget. So economists and other experts gathered at the State House this week to kind of project what kind of fiscal environment we're going to be looking at. And things are still pretty shaky and uncertain, is what lawmakers heard this week, that the state will see impacts from new federal policies, from cuts to health care. The performance of the stock market will obviously have an impact on pretty much anything, including how much the state will take in from its millionaires tax, which has helped keep revenue coming into the state at a time when there has been some economic uncertainty. That money is used for education and transportation. One thing that budget writers are also watching is a proposed ballot question for 2026 that would lower the state's income tax rate. The State Department of Revenue is projecting that would cost state government about $4 billion or $5 billion in revenue. Now, another way of looking at that is it could save taxpayers that amount of money. But that's something that lawmakers are watching cautiously because it could translate to cuts to programs and services if they're not getting that amount of revenue in.
Katie Lannon from the State House, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We are well into the season when turtles and other marine species wash ashore on Cape beaches from the freezing temperatures. But while turtles and sharks generally get the headlines, there's another species on the radar of some researcher, and that is torpedo rays. CIA's Sam Houghton is here with more. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
All right, first of all, what is a torpedo ray, and are they common around here?
Yeah, so right. They can get pretty big. I think females, which are larger, get up to about 200 pounds. They're kind of chocolatey brown on the top and white on the bottom, described as blobby, but a ray nonetheless. And I'll say, you know, there was a blurb issued in some news reports of thresher sharks washing ashore, and they mentioned this increase in torpedo rays. And I never heard of them.
Me either.
I want to learn a little bit more. What are they? And I think interesting we can get into, but biologists don't really know a lot about them either.
Yeah. So the researcher that you spoke with says they're seeing more and more of these wash ashore here, right?
Yeah. We don't have the hard data. I'll be careful saying there is a trend, but we spoke with Krill Carson. She's a marine biologist with the New England Coastal Wildlife Alliance. They're a nonprofit, kind of a volunteer operation. They respond to marine strandings. She said over the last 5 years, they've really seen an increase in these. They've had close to 50 strandings this year, a little more, or I guess a little less than last year, but a big increase from the last five. And now part of that could be more and more people are learning to report marine strandings. So that could be one of the reasons, but she said firsthand, she's really seen an increase and it's concerning to her.
Yeah.
And the second part of the story, she's studying these torpedo rays, any that have washed ashore and have died. She's taking those, looking at the inside, you know, studying whatever she can and sending them off to labs for testing. And, you know, I was saying there really isn't a lot that we know about these species, and that's largely because they aren't fished, you know, recreationally or commercially. So in a way, it leads to kind of a void in information.
So what do you do if you find a cold stunned torpedo ray?
Yeah. So basically call Marine Stranding Operations. I'm not sure some of the bigger operations will have time to respond, but Krill said that her operation, they kind of respond to the misfits, marine animals, the ones that don't get a lot of attention, gulls being there too. So, and that's the New England Coastal Wildlife Alliance, and they have their contact online.
All right. Thanks, CAI's Sam Houghton. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
More than 100 years ago, a wealthy Massachusetts astronomer managed to convince much of the country that there was proof of life on Mars. Former science journalist David Barron wrote a book that traces the rise and fall of that theory, including the role of two Western Massachusetts academics. NEPM's Karen Brown has more.
As a kid in the 1960s and 70s, David Barron, like many others, was fascinated by Mars.
It was a popular sitcom back then called My Favorite Martian, about an alien from the Red Planet who crash-landed his flying saucer in California. There were Martians in the comics and Martians in sci-fi. And now, as an adult, as a science writer, I came to wonder where all that came from.
For his latest book, The Martians, Barron looked into one source of that fascination, a Harvard astronomer named Percival Lowell, who came from the same textile family the city of Lowell was named after. In the early 1900s, Lowell aimed his telescope at Mars and thought he could see a network of straight lines on the planet's surface. He decided they were intentionally made canals.
And Percival Lowell came up with his elaborate theory to explain what people were seeing on Mars, that the planet was running out of water and that the civilization on Mars, in order to survive, had to create this global irrigation network. And that's what the canals were.
To bolster this theory, Lowell hired a couple from Western Massachusetts, David Todd, an astronomy professor at Amherst College, and his wife, the writer Mabel Loomis Todd. The Todds managed to dismantle and move a giant telescope from Amherst College to South America so they could get a better look at Mars while it was passing close to Earth.
David Todd took 10,000 photographs of Mars. Now, these were tiny photographs, just a quarter inch across, but that was the best that astrophotography could do at the time. They touted them as incontrovertible proof that these fine straight lines on Mars were really there.
This belief moved from the tabloids to mainstream media, like the Wall Street Journal, and then to the culture at large.
There were pastors sermonizing about the Martians in church. Alexander Graham Bell said he was totally on board. He saw no doubt that there was a civilization on Mars. It really became almost accepted fact.
But eventually, Barron says, the astronomy community took apart the theory and determined that what Lowell and the Todds actually saw were optical illusions.
The eye has a tendency to see patterns where there aren't any, and the eye might be connecting up dots as straight lines.
Lowell's reputation never recovered. He died in 1916. David Todd lost his Amherst job due to mental illness. Mabel Todd focused on her literary profession as the first publisher of Emily Dickinson's work. But despite how it all ended, Barron says the Mars craze had a huge impact on the culture's imagination for years to come.
Of course, the idea that Mars had this utopian society 100 years ago turned out to be pure illusion. We were projecting onto the planet what we wished was there. I think we're doing the same thing today. I'm actually in favor of sending astronauts to Mars and maybe someday colonizing Mars. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we think it's going to be some magical solution to Earth's problems. It's not.
And Barron says the whole episode acts as a case study on how unproven scientific theories, from canals on Mars to the linking of vaccines and autism, can take hold, especially during the age of social media.
So the cautionary part is just how easy it is for false ideas to spread. How easy it is for us as individuals to convince ourselves that things are true because we so wish they were true, and to look at the evidence in a biased way that supports our beliefs and to discard anything that goes against us.
David Barron lives in Colorado. His new book is called The Martians, the true story of an alien craze that captured turn-of-the-century America. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Karen Brown.
And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.